Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Obama's visit to the El Reno Federal Correctional Institution in Oklahoma, the first president to spend time behind bars with prisoners, leading Obama to say after his tour of the prison, "But there but for the grace of God," and that is something we all have to think about. A retired judge and the founder and executive director of Middle Ground Prison Reform, Donna Hamm, joins us to discuss Obama's recent call for an overhaul of America's criminal justice system, which has led to the international disgrace that the U.S., with less than 5% of the world's population, has more than 20% of the world's prison population. Then, on the one-year anniversary of the downing of the Malaysian Airlines flight MH17 by a Russian missile over disputed Ukrainian territory that killed all 298 aboard the civilian airliner, we will speak with Floyd Wisner, the principal of Wisner Law Firm. He specializes in aviation law and is representing relatives of at least 17 victims of the atrocity, which is being investigated by the Dutch Safety Board, as well as by a second criminal inquiry. And last week, Russia opposed a UN resolution under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter to establish an international tribunal to investigate the shootdown. Then finally, we will speak with award-winning investigative journalist Max Blumenthal about his new book, The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza, and his latest article at Tom Dispatch and the Huffington Post, The Fire Next Time. We will discuss whether, as Israel's foreign minister, Avigdor Lieberman, has declared a fourth operation in the Gaza Strip is inevitable, just as a third Lebanon war is inevitable. And joining us now is Donna Hamm, who is a retired judge, who is the founder and executive director of Middle Ground Prison Reform, an all-volunteer nonprofit organization that works to reform Arizona's criminal justice system in terms of executive clemency, such as commutations of sentence and imminent danger of death, parole, revocation, modification of release conditions, and absolute discharge. She is a former lower court judge in Conanico and Maricopa counties, as well as a former town magistrate pro tem. Welcome to Background Briefing, Donna Hamm.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Donna Hamm, this is an extraordinary event that took place today at the medium security prison at El Reno Correctional Institution in Oklahoma, where the President of the United States literally sat behind bars with a group of prisoners. And on his way out, as I mentioned, he said, "There, but for the grace of God," and that is something we all have to think about. How does it strike you, this gesture on the part of the President of the United States, the first president to ever set foot inside a jail, as far as I know?
Well, it's encouraging. It's even heartening that he would choose to make his message be combined with being in a prison facility with the actual people, possibly who have who've been the victims of these kinds of unjust sentences that we have. But I would remain cautiously optimistic about just how far or how much life this this rally has, because there are so many other problems facing our Congress. And this is not a new idea to reform the sentencing code in the federal criminal code. It's been around for a long time, and we just haven't gotten the wheels under it to make anything happen. So my concern is whether the steam will go out of this because of other issues. And so it's up to us, the ones who are sort of boots on the ground in the activism world, to keep this alive with our Congress representatives.
Well, I think your point is well taken, Donna Hamm, because in terms of attention, all of the news attention today has shifted because a 24-year-old Mohammed Yusuf Abdulaziz, who was born in Kuwait and grew up in an affluent suburb of Chattanooga, Tennessee, killed four Marines today. And obviously, this is a probably going to make life difficult for the president, particularly in terms of, you know, some of his opponents saying, you know, why are you visiting a bunch of prisoners when four of our brave soldiers are killed by a terrorist? So,
well, I'd like to just interject to say that probably his Secret Service detail would not have allowed the president to go to an area where a terrorist attack occurred, essentially because who knows how big or large the plan was. There could have been other people involved. So I don't think having the president fly into the actual area where a known terrorist attack occurred would have been very fortuitous on today's date anyway. But certainly the president cannot be faulted for continuing with a plan that he had to go to the prison. And, you know, but you're absolutely right. If everybody remembers Bill Clinton, when he was president, who started all of this mandatory minimum chaos and who signed the Anti-Terrorism and Death Penalty Act and who really engaged with Congress in knee-jerk reactions that were not well thought out after the Oklahoma bombings. That's what got us, that kind of legislation that was not well thought out about its collateral consequences is what got us to where we are today. So hopefully there will not be a renewed effort now because of what happened in Chattanooga for additional knee-jerk reactions that will bury this concept of considering you know, reducing mandatory minimums for nonviolent offenders.
And of course, Bill Clinton on Wednesday, before the NAACP, admitted that the crime bill that he signed into law as president in 1994 worsened the nation's criminal justice system by increasing prison sentences. And he went on to say that the three strikes crime bill contributed to the problem of overpopulated prisons. And it's worth noting.
Well, it's terrific that he's willing to admit that now. But the number of lives of families, not just the people who went to prison, but their children, their spouses, their parents who died while those people were in prison, the number of lives destroyed is pretty hard to reconcile with someone simply being sorry a decade and a half later.
Well, he did say that the $10 billion in that crime bill went to build new prisons, and they essentially ran out of money to take care of the prisoners. I mean, is that what happened?
Well, essentially, yes. I mean, Arizona is a good example because we have one of the highest per capita incarceration rates. We have an enormous criminal justice system now, burgeoning prison system. It encouraged the proliferation of private prisons, which here in Arizona, and we don't even object per se to private prisons, but we see them with guaranteed occupancy rates, with no accountability, with costs that are higher per capita per prisoner than the state-operated systems, and with not enough oversight by the Department of Corrections that's operating them in the state system. So this spawned a lot of growth and problems in every direction. And my concern is that all of this talk today about reducing mandatory minimums, not sending so many people to prison, is going to have a negative impact on some very powerful people. For example, the prison guards union in California is one of the most powerful, well-funded organizations in that state at the legislature. And they have an impact when they talk about keeping people in prison. And other states have other lobbyists who have an interest in keeping the prisons full. So this is not an easy sell, at least from my perspective in Arizona. And, you know, I have to be a little bit pessimistic about what may happen at the state level. And, of course, nothing that the president was talking about has anything to do with the state prisons. It all impacts the federal prison only.
And that's what, about 10 or 15% of the population? Prison population.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Again, I'm speaking with Donna Hamm, who's a retired judge, who's the founder and executive director of Middle Ground Prison Reform, an all-volunteer non-profit organization that works to reform Arizona's criminal justice system in terms of executive clemency, such as commutation of sentences and imminent danger of death, parole, revocation, modification of release conditions, and absolute discharge. She's a former lower court judge in Coconino and Maricopa counties, as well as a former town magistrate pro tem. And, you know, the idea that the president of the United States went behind bars with prisoners, and apparently the exchange with a number of prisoners was filmed for a Vice News documentary that's going to be shown later on HBO. But, you know, it's interesting in a way that here's a president that we know as a young man smoked marijuana and tried cocaine. And I think that may be what he might have been suggesting, but for the grace of God, given that close to one in every 12 black men between 25 and 54 are imprisoned, and you can compare that with one in 60 non-black men in the same age group. So it's a pretty stark statistic, wouldn't you say?
Well, it absolutely is, and this, I mean, I wish, I'm glad he did what he did. I'm glad he spoke to prisoners personally. Knowing the system as I do, I suspect that the prisoners chosen to actually meet with the president were very carefully chosen, and I guess I wish that he could have gone into the bowels of the prison to see all the mentally ill prisoners who often end up, because of inability to cope with prison rules, who end up for extraordinary amounts of time in solitary confinement. The justice system all the way up and down is broken in the United States, both in the federal system and in the state systems. And we really do have serious problems with the way justice is administered. But it isn't just the racial and ethnic minorities. It's to mentally ill people. And so we have to incorporate those people, because we've closed mental institutions and now we fill up the prisons with mentally ill as well.
Well, given that there are 2.2 million Americans behind bars and that the federal prison population is seven times what it was 40 years ago, you have to ask yourself, you know, we know what's driving it. And the former president, Bill Clinton, admitted that he may have contributed to this overpopulation. But the idea that people profit from this mistake, it seems dysfunctional in any society that calls itself civilized, that people should profit from a social ill. A social ill is something that should be solved and dealt with, not exploited.
Well, we have for-profit hospitals, and we have the military who have private contractors who build weapons for our country and aircraft and so on. So I'm not sure that there's an exact apples-to-apples distinction there, but certainly if whoever is providing the incarceration, and no one here is arguing that there aren't people who should and deserve to be in prison, but we have to consider that they need to be treated humanely. That has to be part of the equation, an important part, the most important part. And we have to prepare these people for release, because despite the mandatory minimums, despite the harsh sentences, the vast majority of prisoners all throughout the country, federal and state, will eventually be released. And so we also have to address the issue of, and the president did discuss this with his NAACP speech, ban the box and allow these people to come back into the community and rejoin society after having paid their debt, and not make them wear that scarlet letter for the rest of their life. That's what we do to people.
But surely there is a distinction, I mean, a difference here in terms of economics between a state institution and a private one. The private one, you know, the state institution doesn't have to make a profit. The private one does have to make a profit. And presumably that profit comes at the expense of services. Isn't that logical?
It is logical, and yet I will tell you that our mailbag, we get a good 300 or so letters a month from prisoners, both from the state-operated institutions as well as the privates. And with the exception of the Kingman private prison, which has recently been in the news here in Arizona because of a riot over the 4th of July weekend, but the private prisons in Arizona, generally speaking, we don't get as many complaints about them. The horror stories that have occurred with murders, with sexual assaults against prisoners, with escapes, with corruption, those occur, for the most part, statistically, in Arizona, in the state-operated prisons. So, you know, you have to say, well, maybe it's better to move some of those people out of that system. And if they are humanely treated, honestly, I don't care if it costs a little more so that they can make a profit doing it. If they are providing humane care that is based on rehabilitation and returns people with a proven lower recidivism rate. And I think that's the criteria that they should be measured on, rather than insisting that they just have 100% occupancy and they get their money no matter what. I think it's the contracts that have been negotiated with these private prisons that are offensive, not the private prisons themselves.
Well, clearly President Obama chose the El Reno medium security prison, or at least his aides did, because it is an example. And he did say it's an outstanding institution because it has lots of job training and drug counseling and other programs, and it's not overcrowded. But he did go into a cell, and he appeared to be quite shocked by the fact that three grown men, as he said, in a 9x10 cell, overcrowding like that is something that has to be addressed. So even in a model prison, the president was pretty shocked by the idea that you have three grown men in a 9x10 cell.
Well, and the only way to address overcrowding is either stop sending so many people to prison or build more prisons so there are more beds. And hopefully we are now moving in the direction, because there has been a steady drumbeat for more prison beds. And certainly that philosophy has been followed here in Arizona with absolutely no interruption. But hopefully the tide will turn a bit and we'll go toward sending fewer people to prison and allowing people who have committed crimes to remain in the community, to pay restitution, to still pay taxes and earn a living to support their families, and yet to be able to go to effective counseling that they can focus on, rather than focusing on whether they're going to be alive the next day because someone in prison stabbed them. So we really do have to begin to be smarter, much smarter on crime than we have been for the last two decades.
Well, I guess to some extent we can take comfort in the fact that there seems to be some bipartisan interest in getting smarter and less punitive about incarceration. You've got Republicans like Senator John Cornyn, Rand Paul, Charles Grassley, and Mike Lee on the Republican side joining with Democrats. And then you've got the Koch brothers, which is a libertarian, very conservative organization. They've joined forces with liberal groups like the Center for American Progress to advocate for change. So there seems to be some middle ground here that presumably can be exploited.
Yes, and we certainly, as I said at the beginning, we would like to see this momentum carry forward. I am a bit skeptical about whether it will, because it has lost steam in the past and been put on the back burner for other more pressing, issues that the public. But if we look at things like gun control, which everyone thought would be the hot topic after certain incidents, each time a very high-profile incident occurs, and yet that has died away. We thought immigration reform would be occurring, and each time it comes up, it gets pushed aside and Congress doesn't deal with it. So I have a bit of skepticism about whether this will remain the hot topic that it is today or this week.
Well, Donna Hamm, I thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for being concerned about this important issue.
And again, I've been speaking with Donna Hamm, who's a retired judge, who's the founder and executive director of Middle Ground Prison Reform, an all-volunteer nonprofit organization that works to reform Arizona's criminal justice system in terms of executive clemency, such as commutation of sentence and imminent danger of death, parole, revocation, modification of release conditions, and absolute discharge. She is a former lower court judge in Coconino and Maricopa counties, as well as a former town magistrate pro tem. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about the one-year anniversary of the shoot-down of the Malaysian airliner over disputed territory in Ukraine.
Yeah. I see my light come shining from the west down to the any day now, any day now, I shall be released.
I have breathed all the sea. You're our friend, prophecy. Our destiny we will not hide. When the sun comes up, it will be on your side.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Floyd Wisner, who's the principal of Wisner Law Firm, specializing in aviation law, who has successfully represented clients in virtually every air crash over the last two decades, an active member of the American Bar Association, Chicago Bar Association, and the Illinois State Bar Association. He's a frequent speaker on aviation law topics and is currently representing relatives of at least 17 victims of the Malaysian airliner shutdown over Ukraine 1 year ago. Welcome to Background Briefing, Floyd Wisner.
Thanks, Ian.
And it is a bit of a puzzlement, don't you think, that this has taken a year and there's still no official inquiry. The Dutch have an inquiry underway, but it's not. It's the Dutch Safety Board. It's aimed only to determine the cause of the crash, not to ascribe blame. There is a separate Dutch criminal investigation underway, and the UN this week there was an attempt at the UN to bring about Chapter 7 of the UN Charter to establish an international tribunal to investigate the shootdown, which Russia is opposing. So what explains this, you know, long delay in getting some justice for those 298 souls who were blown out of the sky on their way from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur?
Well, it sure is a puzzlement, to put it mildly. And that's one of the concerns of our clients and what has motivated us to try to do something for them through the filing of this action. It should not take 1 year to come out with a report setting forth the facts, which I think were known to the principal players almost within days of that shootdown. I think we all know who did it and what happened, but that has been formally announced to the public for over a year now, and why not? And also, why is there any opposition to an international tribunal? That seems like a good idea to everyone. Why is Russia dragging its feet on that? We would like, through this lawsuit, to prompt the diplomatic channels and prompt the political powers that be to do something. Our clients deserve some answers.
Well, tell us about your lawsuit and what's it aimed at.
Well, it's brought under a U.S. federal statute called the Torture Victim Protection Act. And although the word torture is in the title, it provides for a remedy to persons, in fact, non-Americans, aliens, for both torture and for extrajudicial killing. And that's exactly what this is. Extrajudicial killing being a killing not made under authority of any law of the nations. That's what happened here. And that U.S. statute provides a remedy. And that's what we're doing. We're asserting that statute as a basis on behalf of non-Americans to really focus the world's attention on their problems that nothing has been done in about a year. and to try to get some attention, both politically and diplomatically, to find some answers. Mr. Gherkin, Igor Gherkin, who we've sued as a person responsible here, and we've made some allegations against him as the self-styled supreme commander of the rebel separatist forces in that area. He knows. He has information. And we'd like him to appear and provide that information. If he has nothing to hide, he shouldn't have any problem with doing that.
So he was a rebel leader in the area where the plane was shot down, and he was their commander. And he actually at the time of the crash or the shoot down, he went public, didn't he, and said that they'd shot down an Antonov transport plane, and then that posting was quickly scrubbed. But he also these people that Putin's using as surrogates are pretty disgraceful. He also claimed that many of the people on MH17 were dead before the plane took off, and it's amazing that the brazen nature of these false claims of a Ukrainian fighter jet, and suddenly they realize that the pictures are all doctored, and there's nothing that the Russians and their surrogates have ever said that makes any sense at all. So why not nail them? The evidence is there. The AP had a crew of journalists there on the scene who witnessed the Buk ground-to-air missile carrier go by. The Russian officer went over and talked to them. The crew were from the Sakhalin Islands, which are way in the Pacific West. They were intercepted talking about it, and later, you know, they made it clear that they were all sort of saying, "Oops," you know. So we saw that movie before of KL-007. So
sure. Can you imagine how insulting it is to the victims' families to hear this nonsense from these people when we all know what the truth is? It's hurtful and insulting on top of their terrible losses.
So what's at the UN then? You've got the ability to go. Is it you're working through the UN Security Council under Chapter 7?
No. Well, this is a separate U.S. statute that allows us to file suit against Gherkin individually.
Right.
But we sure would like the UN Security Council to do something. So far, their proclamations are toothless. They issued a Security Council resolution, Article 11, which says that we demand that the parties responsible be held accountable. Well, what's been done for that? It seems like Russia is trying to block every movement, particularly with regard to the appointment of an international tribunal.
Right, and that was put forth by Malaysia, Ukraine, the Netherlands, Australia, and Belgium. Course, the Netherlands had most of the casualties on that plane.
That's right.
So, but the Russian ambassador to the UN said that they opposed the adoption of the resolution because, quoting, "it's not a good time and it's counterproductive." We had about a year.
How is it counterproductive?
A year, is that not a good time? Maybe 10 years from now?
Right.
It's amazing how they're so obvious what's going on here. Tell me about what do you think your chances are then in terms of what you're doing?
Well, our chances of ever getting a judgment that we can collect from Mr. Gherkin probably are slim. We recognize that going in. What we do, I think our chances are fairly good, though, of accomplishing our client's real goals, and that is of keeping their case alive, keeping their plight alive, letting the international community know that they're still there and that they're still demanding answers. They want answers. They want information. That I think we might be able to get through this action because of the U.S. legal system.
Of course, the Russian President Vladimir Putin has said that Ukraine is morally responsible for the crash because it occurred in a war that Russia claims was launched by Ukraine, even though Russia actually invaded Ukraine and took Crimea. So that's the sort of Orwellian part of it, I guess, is that what comes from the Russian side is so unbelievably brazenly cynical. But the point that I would make to you, Floyd, is nothing comes from our side. I mean, why is are the Dutch, who suffered most of the victims, the Australians, the Malaysians, why are they so silent?
Right, that's an excellent question, and I don't have an answer to that. I would hope that something like a lawsuit by some attorney in Chicago on behalf of victims' families might shame them a little bit into doing something. They have much, much more power than I ever do as a lawyer. They're the ones that can bring about some answers and information for these victims' families. Do something. Don't make it incumbent upon the victims' families to try to file a lawsuit to get some information. It's inexcusable.
Well, so far there's been apparently a leak from the Dutch Safety Board, or at least a draft of it's been sent out to some of the stakeholders, I guess, that does apparently make it pretty clear that it was the Buk missile fired from the town of Sneezy, which is and you know the plane 3 hours later. That's where the AP journalists saw it, and of course 3 hours later and 6 miles west, the plane was shot down. So. That is that's been apparently looked at. The one thing that I find extraordinary, though, is just going back to the accident itself before it happened, or the incident itself before it happened. Why was it that the Malaysian airliner ignored the NOTAMs, which are notice to airmen, that had been filed over this area, and most of the air carriers had avoided this area as a result of taking notice of the NOTAMs?
Yes, that's an excellent point, and I think Malaysia Air is responsible for that. Now, to be fair to Malaysia Air, they were not the only ones that flew over it, but they were in a minority. Most of the major world's air carriers went around. Why did Malaysia Air decide to go over that area? Terrible, terrible mistake for which they're responsible. I wonder whether finances and economics played a part of that. Were they trying to save fuel by taking a more direct route instead of going around? That would be even more egregious. But regardless, the fact that they flew over that area in with those NOTAMs being out there is just, again, inexcusable.
Well, they'd already had a prior plane incident where a plane disappeared.
Yes.
And I think they're all but bankrupt now, aren't they, Malaysian Airlines?
Right. Yeah. Well, that makes me wonder whether finances did play a part. They had already suffered this loss of MH370. Were they trying to save some money on this one? But wouldn't you think that an airline with that type of disaster that they had with MH370 would be extra, extra careful?
No.
They're another one that Malaysia Air boggles my mind, too.
So what's happening with the other? You know, apparently the Dutch Safety Board, which is not going to assign blame, although it does apparently, the draft of the report says that it was a Buk missile that shot it down, and it came from this village that was under the control of the pro-Russian rebels. What about the criminal inquiry that the Dutch authorities are investigating? Where does that stand?
You know, I think that is basically in limbo. I have no information that that's proceeding at any kind of hurried pace, and I'm not sure why. It certainly would be in their interest. I hate to be critical of the Dutch government, but wouldn't it be in their interest to really move that thing along? I don't understand that either.
Well, have they gone and interviewed people? Do you know whether they've done their legwork?
I don't know that. I have not heard that.
Mm-hmm. You'd think though that all the other countries involved, because I recall when Vladimir Putin went to the G20 conference in Brisbane, Australia, about a year ago. He was pretty much shunned by everybody. Mm-hmm. There's a really sort of famous video of him at lunch, you know, going to the cafeteria and literally sitting alone at a table. Nobody wanted to, even like a pariah. So it's not like the world community doesn't know that he's responsible for it. Has some kind of deal been made just to sort of sweep this under the rug?
That's always a concern. Or is it just a little lack of backbone? What's the problem with standing up to him and getting some answers? You know, and I fault my own country, too, the U.S., even though there's no Americans involved. The U.S. takes an interest in everything that happens in the world. So why not, especially in this case, why doesn't it take a lead and demand some answers?
So you're not holding your breath then over the Dutch Safety Board report coming out in October?
Well, I'm not. But I am gratified to see the leak. The leak actually confirms exactly what we're saying in our lawsuit, which is just a coincidence, but it's nice to know that someone also agrees with us.
Right. But so what's the next step for you then with your lawsuit?
My next step is to serve Mr. Gherkin with process at his home in Moscow. We have an address for him, and we'll serve him with a copy of the summons and complaint, and then it's up to him to see what he will do. He'll have 30 days after service to respond. Probably he, and I'll predict he'll ignore us. And if that happens, we'll get a default judgment against him. But again, the main point is trying to exert some pressure, diplomatic, politically, something to get the world's eyes on this problem and our clients' concerns.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us today, Floyd Weiser.
Thank you, Ian. Enjoyed it.
And again, I've been speaking with Floyd Weiser, who's the principal of Weiser Law Firm, specializing in aviation law, who has successfully represented clients in virtually every air crash over the last two decades, an active member of the American Bar Association, the Chicago Bar Association, and the Illinois State Bar Association. He's a frequent speaker on aviation law topics and is currently representing relatives of at least 17 victims of the Malaysian airliner shot down over Ukraine over a year ago. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into whether there's another war in Gaza and Lebanon are inevitable. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Max Blumenthal, the author of the best-selling Republican Gomorrah and Goliath, and the winner of the Lennon Foundation Cultural Freedom Notable Book Award, a senior writer for Alternet. His latest book just out is The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. And his latest article at Tom Dispatch and The Huffington Post is The Fire Next Time. Welcome to Background Briefing, Max Blumenthal.
Good to be on with you.
And Max, do you expect, in terms of the fire next time, in your piece at Tom Dispatch and Huffington Post, you start the article out by saying, a fourth operation in the Gaza Strip is inevitable, just as the third Lebanon war is inevitable, declared Israeli Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman in February. Since the deal that was announced, the P5+1 deal with Iran, there is a concern, there has been a concern for some time, Dr. Trita Parsi and the former National Intelligence Officer at the CIA on the Middle East, Paul Piller, wrote a piece recently suggesting that Netanyahu may have a war with Lebanon in the summer to scuttle after the Congress has looked at they've got 60 days to review the deal that Obama just made, and that this would be a way to essentially peel off enough Democrats so that Obama's veto could be overridden. So how do you deal with these rumors? Do you think that, it seems like an extraordinary thing to do to have Hezbollah rockets rain down on you just to humiliate Obama. So what's your reading on that?
Well, I don't know if you remember the last time I was on your show before Trita's piece came out and Paul Pillar's piece, but I suggested that Netanyahu might want to do the same thing, which is to provoke a war with Hezbollah. And that was what, when he initiated or at least gave his approval to an Israeli attack on a Hezbollah convoy that included the son of Imad Mughniyeh, who's one of the founders of Hezbollah, it was during his election campaign. And this is when, you know, a counterattack from Hezbollah and any escalation, military escalation, would have benefited Netanyahu. The context for the war that I describe in my book, The 51-Day War, really was Netanyahu manipulating the kidnapping and killing of three Israeli teens through a deception in which he tricked the Israeli public and the world into believing that the teens were alive in order to crush the Palestinian Unity government and create political space for these massive raids on West Bank cities that saw the rearrest of Palestinian prisoners, including much of Hamas's political apparatus in the West Bank. So Netanyahu is not above, and you know, his inner circle, his National Security Council, is not above manipulation, deception, and subterfuge to exploit military escalations to achieve political goals. I wouldn't put anything past them. But I don't think that, let's say, you know, there's a bombing in the Dahiya district by an agent provocateur that kills some Hezbollah official, and it's clearly an Israeli job. I don't think Hezbollah would fall for such a provocation given the stakes of this deal. They are working really closely with Iranian intelligence, the IRGC, and the Assad regime has a lot to gain from this deal as well, and that's the key supply channel to Hezbollah. So it'll be very difficult to see a war take place. But what I wrote in my piece for Tom Dispatch is that the situation on the ground in the Gaza Strip is so bad. There's been no accountability a year after the Israeli military killed 2,200 people, over 500 of whom were children, nearly 900 of whom were killed at home at night, including over 80 families who lost most of its members. Almost none of the 18,000 homes that the Israeli military destroyed have been rebuilt. I mean, we're talking about 20% of the area of land that the Gaza Strip sits on, which is in ruins still. Hundreds of thousands, 100,000 people or so are walking around like ghosts. They're homeless. And there's so that without any resolution to this situation, the Israeli military leadership, the brass, is still stepping up its imprecations against the Gaza Strip. We saw Moshe Yaalon, who is the defense minister of Israel. I mean, you quoted Lieberman at the top of the broadcast, but Yaalon has pledged that another war is inevitable either in Gaza or in Lebanon, and that the Israeli military will attack civilians, including children. In his own words, he said they will hurt children. He said that in May at a conference of the legal group Shurat Hadin. So you have to just listen to the vows that these figures are making. Consider that there's really no, there's even though there may be negotiations between Hamas and the Israeli military intelligence apparatus over the release of prisoners, things like that, there doesn't seem to be an end to this cycle. And it's a cycle that's been brought on by the warehousing of refugees in a stateless area called the Gaza Strip. And that's really the, you know, the context for my book, the 51-Day War.
And again, I'm speaking with Max Blumenthal, who's the author of the best-selling Republican Gomorrah and Goliath and the winner of the Lannan Cultural Foundation Cultural Freedom Notable Book Award, a senior writer for Alternet. His latest book just out is The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. And his latest article at Tom Dispatch and the Huffington Post is The Fire Next Time. But from my understanding, and you give a blow-by-blow account of this 51-Day War, and its aftermath, and my understanding is that the sort of logic behind it, if indeed there is any, is that the Israelis just want to make life so miserable for the people in Gaza that they'll wake up one day and say, we don't like the Hamas government anymore, and somehow kick out Hamas and join with the PA next door on the West Bank, who are so much more compliant. Is that the logic here?
It's exactly the logic. I mean, if the Israeli military intelligence apparatus has a strategy, it's that, which is to commit what the late Israeli sociologist Brooke Kimmerling called politicide, which is the destruction of part or all of a political entity in order to prevent a people's struggle for self-determination. It's basically a political form of genocide. The state of Israel has always sought to crush the Palestinian national struggle by basically forcing Palestinians into the broader Arab world and eliminating them as a nation. And in some senses, that's been achieved in the West Bank through the peace process, which compelled Fatah and the Palestine Liberation Organization, the PLO, to form a Palestinian Authority in which they would coordinate security with the Israeli military. Their forces would be trained by DynCorp, the U.S. mercenary firm, and a U.S. general, Keith Dayton. And they would learn tactics of counterinsurgency to police fellow Palestinians. Now, this is the dream of any occupying settler colonial state, is to have the natives police themselves. And that's what the state of Israel achieved in the West Bank. It essentially created little Bantustans, which are ruled by Mahmoud Abbas, and a very docile set of collaborationists. They achieved this over the course of decades through the assassination of figures who they considered either too intellectual, too sophisticated, or too radical to deal with. And it all left them with Yasser Arafat. In the Gaza Strip, the situation has been much more difficult for the Israelis. Hamas is operating under different parameters. They're an Islamist resistance organization, and for them to coordinate security or sign a permanent status agreement with Israel would be to nullify its charter as a resistance organization. And so far, while the Israeli military has been picking off all the figures that it considers to be irreconcilable within the ranks of Hamas, like Ahmed Jabari, who had killed in 2012, who was sort of the mastermind of the military wing of Hamas, the Al-Qassam Brigades, to more recently the attempts to kill his successor, Mohammed Deif, while allowing people like Ismail Haniyeh, who's the prime minister in Gaza, to rule, these have failed. These have failed because people in the Gaza Strip have resisted Israel with weapons, with arms, since the 1950s. It's just part of the culture of an indigenous people who have been ghettoized and dispossessed. And while there is a lot of criticism of Hamas in the Gaza Strip, especially after the ceasefire deal they accepted in 2014, which really left them with nothing, there is a consensus of support for the Al-Qassam Brigades, which is Hamas's military wing. So the strategy of turning Gaza into a kind of Bantustan like Ramallah has completely failed, and the Israeli military has no other, it will accept nothing less. There may be negotiations right now over a long-term truce with Hamas in the Gaza Strip, but the Israeli military will not accept anything less than full demilitarization of the Gaza Strip, and that's completely unworkable because from the perspective of Palestinians, if they put down their arms, they'll be destroyed and dispossessed and they'll be subjected to the kind of situation that people in the West Bank are facing right now.
Well, clearly, though, in the region, there are a turmoil that is obviously at a broader level affecting Hamas and Israel. The war in Syria has, I think, affected at least the connections that Hamas has had in terms of support from Iran because of Iran supporting Assad. Assad is certainly not treating the Palestinians well. And, of course, the emergence of the Islamic State has it's starting to show some presence in Gaza.
Yeah.
To provoke the Israelis by breaking ceasefires, etc. So walk us through how the broader strategic changes under war because of the war both in Iraq and Syria are affecting the calculus.
Well, during the Arab Spring, Khalid Mishal, who is the head of Hamas's Politburo, led Hamas out of Damascus and out of the Iranian orbit, which is sort of considered an axis of resistance within the Middle East, and into the orbit of the Sunni-dominated sphere that was funded by mainly the Qataris in Doha, who are willing to play oppositional politics once Mohamed Morsi came to power in Egypt. And so Mishal aligned himself with what he considered to be his natural religious and political counterparts in Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood. And
By the way, they were the founders of Hamas, largely, weren't they?
Who had founded Hamas, or in many ways provided the foundational basis for the emergence of Hamas in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. So that was a gambit that proved to be disastrous, because a military coup toppled Mohamed Morsi, the first democratically elected leader in 5,000 years in Egypt. It then led to the Qataris having a rapprochement with the Saudis, who hated the Muslim Brotherhood, considered them a threat, and are the chief funders of the military junta in Egypt, led by Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. So Hamas was in a real bind. What we've seen is them attempt to recover on every level the diplomatic support that they had prior to the collapse, prior to the Arab Spring. And that's been extremely difficult, because the Egyptian regime is hell-bent on destroying them and maintaining a siege on the Egyptian side of Gaza that's even tighter than the one that Israel maintains on the Israeli side. We've seen Israeli military administrators complain that the Egyptian siege is too tight, that it's causing so much despair, that it's leading to the rise of extreme Salafist elements in Gaza who are allying themselves with ISIS. At the same time, earlier this year, during a Hamas military parade for the Al-Qassam Brigades, the military wing of Hamas, we heard Abu Obeida, the spokesman for the Al-Qassam, thank Iran for supporting them during Operation Protective Edge. So there still is Iranian support. There may be increasing Iranian support, but the main supporters of the Gaza Strip remain the Qataris. They're supporting infrastructure projects. They have established a holding firm for rebuilding in Gaza, and they are in a weakened position themselves because of lower gas prices, because of a host of factors, including the nuke in Saudi Arabia. So I just look at Hamas and see a very weakened political entity. Thousands of its employees in the Gaza Strip haven't been paid in over a year. They're working for free. Electricity is cut off for sometimes all but 4 hours a day. Their own constituents are deeply demoralized, and this is something that the Israelis seek to encourage. Looking forward from beyond the Iran deal, the Iran deal will be could potentially be terrible for Palestinians, because the Israelis are going to demand more military hardware and more assistance through Congress as kind of hush money or a bribe. And the Obama administration's put this on the table. They've put on the table $4.5 billion a year in aid over $3 billion, which is an increase of $1.5 billion a year from the $3 billion the Israelis already get. They're talking about selling the Israelis the F-35, which is one of the most advanced weapons in the American Air Force, along with all sorts of technology that the Israelis have consistently used not to attack other conventional militaries, but to attack civilian homes in the Gaza Strip and in southern Lebanon. And so this deal could potentially tighten the vise even further on the Gaza Strip. And just diplomatically, it seems like the Obama administration and Washington is willing to hand over the West Bank to the Israelis in exchange for them not attacking Iran. I haven't seen any pressure on Netanyahu since his reelection to do anything about the record level of settlements he's reauthorizing. So from the standpoint of Palestinians on the ground, this isn't a great deal. And where it leaves a cooperation between Iran and Hamas is anybody's guess.
Well, along with the emergence of the Islamic State in Gaza, albeit not particularly significant at the moment, but they could provoke problems for Hamas with Israel by firing crude rockets. There's also clashes with Islamic Jihad and Hamas, aren't there?
They would be mostly political clashes over how to approach the current situation.
Right.
But these two groups, Islamic Jihad and Hamas, are locally based armed resistance groups that really have no international ambitions and are both condemned by the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda as such. In 2009, there was a ferocious gun battle in the streets of Rafah, which is the southernmost city in the Gaza Strip that borders Egypt. And the commanders who led the Al-Qassam brigades against the extreme Salafist forces who were attempting a power play, Riyad Attar and his lieutenants were assassinated by the Israeli military in 2014. It left a huge security void in Rafah, and the void of stability, the chaos after the war, along with the despair that's sweeping through the Gaza Strip, where we're seeing skyrocketing suicide rates. I mean, people are just the human misery that I witnessed in Gaza was unlike anything I'd ever seen. These are leading to the expansion of the ranks of these extreme Salafists. They've allied themselves with ISIS. It's unclear to me how much direction they're getting from ISIS and from ISIS or the Islamic State in Iraq. But they've adopted a very simple formula that's paying off, and it involves a kind of tacit alliance with the Israelis. They fire kind of a crude rocket with very little payload into some open area in southern Israel, or a mortar, and the Israelis immediately strike back with powerful missiles, not against these Islamic State-allied factions, but against Hamas. So by firing rockets into Israel, they're actually attacking Hamas, and that's what their goal is, because the Islamic State is far more determined to destroy Hamas or attack Hamas than it is to attack Israel right now. In fact, it looks like they've adopted a quietist approach to Israel, which means that they won't attack any Israeli military or civilians until a later date, once they've strengthened their capacity. At the same time, on the northern border of Israel, where Hezbollah is operating, and we've heard Netanyahu in recent weeks warn that Iran and Hezbollah are a far greater threat than ISIS, the Israeli military is openly cooperating with the Al-Nusra Brigade. These are elements that are openly aligned with Al-Qaeda and taking direction from Ayman al-Zawahiri. The Jerusalem Post has reported that Israel is treating fighters from the Nusra Brigade and sending them back into the field. That's the right-wing Jerusalem Post. Why are they doing that?
Right.
To undermine Hezbollah. So they're working directly right now with Al-Qaeda and tacitly with the Islamic State in Gaza to undermine the two forces. Resisted them.
Right. And in the broader strategic picture of the Middle East, they're in a de facto alliance with Saudi Arabia, whose new 29-year-old king, even though the father is nominally the king, is a really hardcore Wahhabi. Well, Max Blumenthal, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Max Blumenthal, is the author of the best-selling Republican Gomorrah and Goliath and the winner of the Lannan Foundation Cultural Freedom Notable Book Award, a senior writer for Alternet. His latest book just out is The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. And his latest article at Tom Dispatch and the Huffington Post is The Fire Next Time. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.